Wonderful. Well, thank you everyone for coming out. Today I'm going to be presenting on a violence intervention strategy that we have in Sacramento. And I'll tell you more about our national network, but we're one of 21 programs in the United States that tried to intervene with youth who've been recently injured by violent crime to prevent retaliation and subsequent cycles of violence. So the name of my presentation, Reducing Youth Violence and Retaliation Through Hospital-Linked Intervention. Before I get started, I'd like to thank our sponsors, if you will. Our program is funded by Kaiser Permanente out of the California region. Okay, so for today, I'd like to give you an overview of the origins of the Sacramento Violence Intervention Program, tell you about its design, some of the outcomes that we've seen in our 3+ years of operation, and also discuss some of our future directions that we should be expecting to see in the next couple of years. So as many of you probably know, youth violence is a gigantic issue in the United States. Youth violence is one of the leading causes of death for our young people, particularly young men of color. Homicide is the second leading cause of death for youth in the United States. And this is not just a national statistic, but it's also something that is very prominent in some of our more urban communities, including South Sacramento, which is where our program is situated. In South Sacramento, violent injury is the third leading cause for hospital trauma visits, and over half of the violence-related injuries are among our young people, 15 to 24. And so that fits really well within our public health models of what youth encompasses, but we're finding that we're losing a lot of our young people to violence. In 2010, there was a community assessment that was done by Kaiser Permanente that showed these statistics and what a huge deal of violence and violence-related injuries were in our community. And right after deciding to start this program, right just at the very beginning when we were looking at design and staffing, there's a traumatic, huge tragedy in our community, which we refer to as the South Sacramento barbershop shooting. What you're seeing here is a picture that was featured in our local newspaper of a mother and her son. That mother, her name is Monique Nelson, and she was a victim of this particular shooting, for those of you who may have heard of it. Basically, what happened in this particular event is that two opposing gang members decided to have a battle in the middle of the day, and we lost a mother who was shielding her almost 2-year-old son in his car seat, and we lost her. And because of that, there was huge community outcry for change. We need to stop, not feeling safe in our community and losing people in the crossfire. As many of you know, particularly if you're in the field of violence prevention and intervention, violence mimics infection. It spreads. And what we know from social psychology and researchers such as Albert Bandura, we learn youth violent behaviors. And people who are growing up in these communities are subjected to violence and post-traumatic stress outcomes constantly. Violence, thank goodness, now is being viewed as a public health issue, which is a relatively recent thing, but something that is very helpful in addressing this issue. And treatment approaches should resemble those that are used to treat infectious diseases, i.e., if we interrupt the next event, transmission, et cetera, we can interrupt the next violent activity. So what we find in our communities is that once one violent activity happens, the victim side then feels the need to retaliate against the original perpetrators, thus creating this battle, this back and forth war. And if we're able to stop that at any point in that cycle, we can change the trajectory of the impact of that one event. So again, SVIP, the Sacramento Violence Intervention Program, was created in 2010 as a way for us to address this issue in our own community. And it is set up in such a way that it's a very close community collaboration based off the Caught in the Crossfire program and a member of the National Network for Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs. And for any of you who have interest in this field or might be already involved, I highly, highly, highly recommend this particular organization for supporting violence interventions in our communities. So I mentioned that SVIP is a collaboration. It's a collaboration between Kaiser Permanente in South Sacramento, which is a leading trauma unit. They just opened that division of the hospital in 2010. It's a level two trauma center. As well as my organization, which is a nonprofit, a community-based organization called Wealth-Based Health. And Wealth-Based Health offers all sorts of wraparound services for people in our community, including primary care. We're a federally qualified health care program, including addiction treatment. We have both inpatient and addictions treatment. Mental health services, individual counseling, couples counseling, child abuse prevention and treatment, parenting classes, centering classes, prenatal care, et cetera. And so the Youth Development Department, which I manage in the organization, is just one of many approaches to public health that we have at WellSpace Health. An additional community collaboration comes from some of the organizations that we're partnering with in the community. So while we have this opportunity to link youth with care of all different sorts once they enter our doors, we also need to reach out to other community resources, like housing resources, like violence intervention programs at a larger capacity. And luckily, that has become something that is very much on the radar of politicians in Sacramento, given incidences like the barbershop shooting in 2010. So the SVIP program was based off of a very widely successful program that is featured in Oakland, California, by the organization, the nonprofit organization Youth Alive. And Youth Alive offers several programs that are looking at youth development from different approaches, and one of them is the Caught in the Crossfire program. The Caught in the Crossfire program, and I'll tell you a little more about it in a moment, what it looks like, it has been shown to have drastic effects on reducing retaliatory violence and violence in the community. Of the people who participated, a study in 2009 showed that 95% of the youth that were involved in Youth Alive's program were able to avoid re-injury. Now, national statistics would make us assume that they have about a 40% chance of re-injury. And to nail that down to 95% is a drastic improvement. Also, 90% were not arrested in the time that they were in the program and subsequently following. So because of the successes of the Caught in the Crossfire program in Oakland, as well as the research that was done on that program, it actually received official Attorney General endorsement in 2009 as something that Janet Reno decided we should be implementing at a national level. A huge victory for youth violence intervention. So what does it look like? Well, the goals of the Caught in the Crossfire model are as follows. First, preventing retaliatory violence. Again, as I mentioned, when you have someone who is victimized, often that victim, family, friends, brothers, cousins, might initially feel the need to retaliate. How do we stop that? How do we stop that from becoming a war after one bad thing happens? Preventing re-injury. We need to drop that 40% down, right? How do we do it? We need to decrease their arrest rates and inform and train individuals and groups on alternatives to violence. How do we get into the schools before that violence happens? How do we get in the community to create a presence that shows our young people that violence is unacceptable? So the Caught in the Crossfire model looks like this. It is based off of the primary principle of immediate response. When a young person is injured, who is between the ages of 25 to 24, they're either shot, stabbed, or assaulted, and residing within our service area, we have 1 hour to respond to them at bedside in the hospital. So we get that phone call, we jump in the cars, and go. And not only are we providing support for that individual, but we're also providing support for their moms, or brothers, or cousins, or friends, anyone who might be considering retaliatory violence, but also helping them understand the situation, serving as liaisons in some degree, to inform the patients and their families about the medical situation, because they're not in that environment all the time, right? And how do you make that something that's approachable to our clients? After a young person decides to join the program or they're consented by their parents, we work with that young person for 6 months to a year with long-term follow-up care. And we work with them one-on-one to create an individualized case plan based off of whatever they need to be doing in their lives to create a safer environment and to move their lives forward. So a lot of the case plan items that we end up seeing are things like health. How do we get that person follow-up care? Are they eligible for various insurance plans that we might have in our community? How do we get them the psychosocial support they need to heal from that violent injury and to experience as few psychological repercussions of their injury as possible? And what are their educational or career goals? How do we get them job training? How do we get them back in school or get their GED? So we provide this through intensive case management, again, for 6 months to a year, and link them to our community resources. Also, SVIP, as with the Caught in the Crossfire program, are both members of the National Network for Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs. Again, there are 22 programs of that sort in the United States, and they're the ones setting the national standards and best practices for violence intervention. They're also leaders in research about vicarious trauma, post-traumatic stress symptoms, and trauma-informed care. For those of you who might be interested in implementing a program of this sort, I highly recommend this book that you can actually download in a PDF for free off the internet if you go to NNHVIP's website. And it is a guide to identifying the population, securing hospital buy-in, having community partnerships, and developing and supporting staff in this sort of intervention program. This is the actual cover of the book, The Best Practices Guide to Launching and Sustaining a Hospital-Based Program to Break the Cycle of Violence. So this particular book is looking mostly from a hospital-based intervention. So for those of you who are working in hospitals, how do you create a subdivision that is focused on youth violence? But it also provides information for partnering organizations. So if you are part of a nonprofit, for example, that does case management or health and human services, how do you link with hospitals and get that buy-in and make it sustainable? So SBIP has been a member since its inception. And we currently participate on three of their four working groups, including research and evaluation, because I'm a major geek, as evidenced by me teaching at Sac State, workforce development, and also policy. Some additional program components that make SBIP different than most other programs in the network, and unique among those in the state as a whole, is that we have an in-house GED program that offers instruction and one-on-one tutoring. And as mentioned before, teaching at a university gives me a pool of very eager young people who have made it forward in their lives, who might come from very similar backgrounds but are really succeeding. And because of that, I have a pretty good pool of volunteers. I would highly recommend checking into linking with universities for this sort of work, assuming, of course, close supervision. So the in-house GED program that we have is held two times a week, and we have very, very good attendance of our participating members. And it's basically free to implement. I spent, $186, I think, on the original GED workbook. And everything since then has been based off of volunteers from the university who really want to contribute to their community. So they're teaching the classes with supervision. And they are performing one-on-one tutoring with the young people who are now they're now taking their tests. So we're really excited about that. And so far have been acing them so far. So I'll be sure to check back in with everyone about what that looks like. So in addition to the primary benefits of course, moving education goals forward and career goals forward, there have been some secondary benefits that we could have guessed or hypothesized that we would see, but we're really, really now seeing, including group cohesion. Our young people, who oftentimes come from opposing sides of the line, we'll say, or the track, they are very, very cohesive. They're like brothers, and they say it all the time, like, we are family here. This is our family. Also, of course, increased protective factors. We know that education is a huge protective factor for violence. And increased individual buy-in. So when we have additional program objectives or we want them to engage in deeper ways, we know them very, very well. So it increases the safety and overall cohesion of the group. Another thing that we offered, and we'll be offering again, was a digital storytelling project. And our digital storytelling project was an 8-week program, and we partnered with people who are leaders in this particular realm of narrative therapy. But digital storytelling is a process by which you help someone to write out a narrative of their story. And that story can look at their life chronologically since the beginning that they can remember, or it could be of a particular event, really anything that they want. And we work with the youth to create this narrative script that they then record as a voiceover. And then they go into their communities and they take pictures. We talk about metaphor and symbols, and they take pictures and video that then are overlaid to their narrative. And then it'll be about 3 or 4 minutes long. But it's very closely tied to narrative therapeutic approaches. And we were very, very lucky to have a partnership with members at UC Davis to help us with that. Another thing that we tried this year as an intervention was our We Fit Challenge. A lot of our youth are injured in their communities. They are shot in their neighborhoods, they are stabbed in their neighborhoods, or assaulted in their neighborhoods, or on the way to school, or near school. And for those reasons, as you might imagine, they have reluctance to leave the home. Fear is huge, particularly right after injury. Of course it is, right? That makes a lot of sense. But it makes an additional challenge of getting well. How does one exercise when you're afraid of leaving your house? You know, I tried to have a group barbecue with all of our kids. I love when they call them my kids, even though a lot of them are grown adult men. Anyway, but our participants. And I created a council of them that are advisors to a lot of our decisions. And we were trying to choose a location, and naming the parks in the area, all of our youth had, at least one youth was injured in all the parks in the area. So I cannot take them to those parks, right? I'm not going to put them in danger of re-injury. I'm not going to gather a lot of potential targets into one space. So that becomes an additional challenge. So this year, we got a small grant from the Health Education Council to create what we call the We Fit Challenge, which incorporated healthy eating and active living within a safe environment. So we closed our medical clinic, and at night we got the guys all together, and we had them play these Wii Fit sports games against each other. And whoever lost had to pull from a Wii Fit deck, which is basically a deck of cards that has all these exercises on it. And then in addition, we also taught them about healthy eating. How do you prepare particular fruits and vegetables? Where do you get them? What type of recipes do you like with them? And that showed some pretty good successes for its first year. Another main focus of our program is the power of exposure, where we're trying to expand their worldview and give them the permission to dream. So I was having this discussion, just kind of timely, but 2 weeks ago I was teaching a class at Sac State with seniors, and they were debating, it was a debate class. Anyway, and they were talking about whether or not people have free will. Whether the decisions of where you are in the world, is it because of your own decisions that you got here, or is it partially due to genetics or personal limitations, right? How much of it is on you? And one of my students said, you know, I pulled myself up from my bootstraps, I came from a very tough environment, and then I made it, and that's all on me. Those are all decisions. Right. So I love these teachable moments. Aren't they wonderful as educators? You're like, okay, great. I'm so glad that you said that, because now you can lay in on it, right? But people are only able to dream within the realm of what they know is possible, right? And if we never show kids anything that they haven't seen before, they don't know the difference. So a couple years ago, we were writing with one of the youth in my program, and just asked him, what's the furthest you've ever been from your house? And he lives in South Sacramento. And he says, well, it was Elk Grove. Elk Grove is 2 freeway exits from his house. That is the furthest this kid had been. I was like, all right. Great. And we can work with it. So based off of that, we decided to take the youth in our program to San Francisco for a day. We got all of the staff, brought their personal cars, we put the kids all in the car, and we're watching as their faces just light up. They had never seen a city before. They'd never seen the ocean before. They'd never seen a bridge before. All of these things that we take for granted, they had never seen. And on this particular day, we decided to take them to the Academy of Sciences, which is this fantastic, fantastic science museum in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And one day a month, it used to be, now it's one day a year, they have a free day. You can bring whoever you want. So we're like, okay, we're going to take advantage of this. We take the kids, bring them in there, and we bring them to the planetarium. They are laying on their backs and they're looking at the stars in the dome. They've never even heard of a planetarium, let alone seen one, right? And we walk out of there, and one of the kids, who's 14, he goes, people can study stars? Right. Yes, honey, they can. You can study stars. These things are possible. But without knowing what is available in the world, how can you dream? So we are obsessed with this idea, the power of exposure. We're constantly contacting members in our community to see what museums can we get into, what live music and art and dance and culture can we expose our kids to. They haven't seen any of these things. But once they have, that expands what they know is possible. So another huge, huge part of our program. This picture was taken last week with a new group of kids in San Francisco, and they're cold. Yes, it's really hot in Sacramento and really cold in San Francisco. Yeah, so they learned that. Okay, so program outcomes. So far to date, we've had about 140 clients and families who've been served. And again, we want to wrap our arms around not just the kid, but also their brothers, sisters, cousins, whatever's going to make them have the highest chances of success. Because as we know, when we have someone who is going back to that dangerous environment, it's hard for them to make life changes. So how do we support everyone in supporting that youth and themselves, right? And so far, our program has had tremendous, tremendous success. As I was saying about the Caught in the Crossfire program, Janet Reno endorsed it in 2009 based off of that, you know, 95% failure to re-injure statistic. We've had one kid ever re-injured. One. 99.3% of our youth have not been rehospitalized due to a violence-related injury. 95% of them have not been arrested for a new offense, and 40% have gained employment. Now, that statistic has just bumped. It was probably something like 20% a year ago. In this year, we have a third of our kids currently employed. And that speaks to our local economy as well. But the jobs are coming to them. And also, we're having an opportunity to advocate for them. Okay. Is the next presenter here, or do I have a little more time than anticipated? I do? Great. Okay. Well, I would like to share with you guys one of the radio pieces that was then turned into film on one of our clients to kind of give you a more in-depth picture of what our program looks like and what our youth look like.